We have heard we're on 07-12. We have heard from Judge McMonigal. Our next appearance is District 3 Court Administrator Mike Nyman. Mr. Nyman.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, it is an honor to present in front of you today on the subject of video conferencing. Video conferencing means for us, there's a quote from Ron Stupak, a respected consultant in court administration, that sums it up very nicely. All of us in leadership roles must help our courts to adapt, innovate, and sometimes even transform. Video conferencing touches on all three of these. Video conferencing is part of a $5 billion market that includes audio, video, and web conferencing. Currently, 100 federal court sites make use of video conferencing, including criminal proceedings, sentencing, settlement conferences, witness appearances and trials, and arraignments. Virtually every state in the union has some form of video conferencing occurring in their court system. Florida and California have extensive experience, while New Jersey claims to have one of the largest video conferencing networks for court systems, which include courtrooms, appellate divisions, law centers, and public defender's offices. Here in Wisconsin, we too have been in the process of transforming. In 2003, the Office of Justice Assistance reported that 35% of the courthouses and 45% of the county jails had video conferencing capabilities. Now, today, that number is 90% and increasing. All the state correctional facilities and mental health facilities are utilizing video conferencing as well. The entities that use video conferencing see the potential benefits of video ranging from reducing transportation costs, increasing staff productivity, increased case dispositions, reducing average length of stay in jails, increased security for all court participants, staff, and law enforcement personnel, reducing county health care costs for inmates, and it maintains the quality of medical care and treatment for incarcerated individuals. When the term video conferencing is used for the courts, many individuals immediately think of a situation of a criminal homicide case, trial, and a defendant not being allowed to appear. This is far from what is intended and what is factually occurring. In criminal matters, the majority of use across the nation and in Wisconsin has been in the area of initial appearances, arraignments, and various non-evidentiary type hearings. In data collected for Waukesha County over the last 5 years, 94% of the events were outside of a court or jury trial setting. The average length of time for those hearings was 14 minutes. Another area that video has found extensive use has been in the mental health matters. In many situations, the patient is brought down in chains. Video conferencing removes that in indignity. The data from Waukesha showed that in a probable cause hearings held by video, the average length of the matter was less than 10 minutes. More importantly, the information we are receiving from the institutions is that the patients prefer this method of appearing. The list of supporters for the new rule is lengthy. Included in the list is the State Bar's Board of Governors' unanimous approval of this petition. It is not surprising that the bar members are interested in expanded use of video. In a survey conducted with the Waukesha County Bar 7 years ago, 88% of the respondents indicated they were willing to use video. 71% of the respondents handled criminal matters. When asked if the video allows for the facts to be presented, over 73% agreed. In addition, 77% believe that video provided a dignified, humane proceeding. The state, county, nor the court system cannot build or transport their way out of the fiscal burdens in the future. We need to put in place rules and procedures that are flexible in nature to meet these hurdles, adapt or transform with the rapidly changing technologies while safeguarding the rights of the litigants. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak here today.
I have a question, if I may.
Yes, Justice.
use of video conferencing at plea hearings is a concern of mine. How do you see this playing out with the proposed rule? I have in mind, I was just reading the Van Patten decision that just came down from the United States Supreme Court. And in Van Patten, in our court, in the state court, was it over in Shawnee County? I forget what county. Yeah, Shawnee. You know, you had a homicide plea, and the defendant's attorney was not present. Do many pleas take place in the world of video conferencing in the state of Wisconsin?
I cannot speak to the exact number, but yes, pleas do take place in other states and here in Wisconsin. It is done by stipulation. I know of no case law or situation where the plea was taken over the objection of defense or the objection of the defendant.
Yeah, but then it can quickly translate perhaps into an ineffective assistance of counsel argument. You know, okay, no objection was made, but they were ineffective for not raising the objection. One of the things that I'm thinking of is the concern voiced by Justice Stevens in this very recent, I don't know if you've seen it, but essentially
yes,
he quoted from the Seventh Circuit decision, which said, you know, here's this defendant in a homicide case, and he's not able to communicate the nuances, the body language isn't able to be observed between the attorney and the client in this most important of cases, a plea in a homicide action. He's not able to sometimes quickly say, and I'm paraphrasing Justice Stevens, but he's not, advance arrangement has been made for a private line in a private place, and even if one could perhaps have been provided, it would have required a special request by Van Patten and a break in the proceedings, and that didn't happen. So how do you control some of these concerns, or how do you address some of these concerns in the proposed rule?
I'm sorry. Yes, we have. Well, first of all, Van Patten was on a telephone conference,
that's
and with
right.
Video conferencing, there's multiple ways we can and have been doing this. One is you have the benefit of video, so you're seeing and hearing, which does provide a greater spectrum of what's happening in front of somebody. Also, we do provide private lines with either a landline or a cell phone prior to the court starting, there's arrangements made with the court as to how they can make these conversations with the client. Judges are willing to take a break or allow the parties to talk while the court is in session, that kind of thing. So we've had different ways of handling it with phone access in the courtroom, mute buttons on or cough switches on microphones. And also, I've talked and presented on this to say, don't use the video, the kind of video quality that you have, the kind of units you have in your courtroom. Use them to the extent that they can be used. Don't use them for something beyond their capabilities. And we haven't had an issue with the multiple plea hearings that have gone on under stipulation.
When I left the circuit court, teleconferencing was just starting. We didn't have the PPAC story scenario at that time in progress. And I remember using video conferencing, for instance, at Lincoln Hills. But that was about the extent of it. And since I've been on this court, I've had the opportunity to see video conferencing in operation in a couple of the circuit courts. courts, but just limited. You know, I'll be there for an hour and watch it and then talk to someone. And so I haven't had the experience of real day-to-day working with video conferencing in a wide area of cases. And so it is, I guess, in the criminal case that causes me, and at the plea stage, that causes me some of the most concerns. But you're saying from the experience that you have as a district court administrator that those concerns seem to be able to be addressed by voiced and that Justice Stevens was voicing?
We stress with the courts, and the courts have done this, is working with the attorneys and what is the accommodation. And that's where we start from. What is the accommodation you need for us to be able to interact with your client? Again, it's under stipulation. They could be with their client. Some choose not to. Some choose to be in the courtroom. The client's remote. Some will go with their client. But it starts from the basis of what can we do for you. There's also things like faxing capabilities, being able to fax back and forth information. In the future, it's going to be emailing and other kind of modes of exchange of paperwork, getting the paperwork ahead of time, allowing the attorney to speak with their client before the court even comes into session by video. And that kind of thing. So we do try to make whatever arrangements we can to accommodate what counsel needs to get their job done and to provide effective counsel, both beforehand and during the court hearing.
Mr. Nyman, I want to make sure I understand this petition. And I'm looking at 68.05. And that relates to criminal cases under and proceedings under 48, 51, 55, and 938. So it's criminal plus mental, 51, 55, et cetera. 48 is what, juvenile?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And it's been suggested that 980 be put in there. Do you have any objection to that? Or does the committee have any objection? 980 is sexual offenders. Okay. That's my first issue. And as I read this, the trial court in a criminal case, etc., may, on its own motion or at the request of a party, permit the use of video conferencing in any pretrial, trial, or fact-finding or post-trial proceeding. As I understand it, because the trial court would allow video conferencing for a smidgen of a trial or a smidgen of pretrial, doesn't mean it's for everything.
Correct.
You do it proceeding by proceeding. Okay, that's one thing. Okay. So 6805 is generally may. Okay. 2A says that a defendant and a respondent under the other proceedings is entitled to be physically present in the courtroom at all critical stages, and somebody suggested you put also have other persons present there, including evidentiary hearing, trial or fact-finding, plea hearings at which there's a plea taken, and sentencing or dispositional hearings. So 2A, as I read it, takes away the discretion under subsection 1 if the defendant or respondent objects to video conferencing and wants to be physically present in the courtroom. Is that right?
That's correct.
At least for plea, I'm sorry, at least for evidentiary hearings, trial or fact-finding hearings, plea hearings, and sentencing or dispositional. Now, bail isn't listed there. I mean, I don't know if bail would be considered an evidentiary hearing or a fact-finding hearing, for example.
That's not considered.
Pardon me?
Not considered for bail or
so bail would allow video conferencing despite somebody's objection.
Yeah, non-evidentiary, yes.
Yeah, okay. So one is broad discretion at trial court. Two says not if the defendant objects at least to those proceedings listed there, right?
That is correct.
And then B, 2B says a proponent, B deals with a witness that may be part of video conferencing. And then C and D, as I read C and D, are really deal with B. They should really be 1 and 2 under B. If made by, and that's, I don't know what if made by the petitioner means. I guess it's not B. It relates to 2A. Okay. If I'm reading it right. All right. So, have I read this appropriately? That is, discretion, defendant can object, and then if the subsection 1, what is it made by the plaintiff or petitioner in a matter in 1? Is that the special proceedings? Not under the criminal statute?
I'm sorry, is there...
I want to know what the reference in subsection 1 is. Is it to all of subsection 1, 48, 51, 55, 938, and criminal cases?
If I may, Chief Justice, that was an area of what Judge Leinweber was going to speak on.
All right, that's fine. All right.
Legally, he's the...
All right, I accept that, and I want, unless there are other questions of Mr. Nyman by the court, I want to say, Mr. Nyman, I know that as part of your educational program as a district court administrator, you have specialized in video conferencing and have written in this field and have followed it very closely, and the whole court system has had the benefit of your training and expertise, and I want to, on behalf of the entire court, thank you for that.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Chief, I do have a question.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Nyman, the Department of Justice, through the Deputy Attorney General, Ray Tafora, expressed a number of concerns, not having to do so much with the civil side as with the criminal, juvenile, child protective mental health side. Now, I know there was a follow-up letter within the last couple of days indicating that they now were going to take no position in regard to whether the court should adopt that particular part of this petition. I'm wondering whether or not there's been any discussion with you and the two judges that are here today concerning whether or not you feel that the concerns of the Department of Justice are met by this petition. Certainly they had some significant concerns, I thought.
Their concerns were for civil liberties and civil rights.
Absolutely.
Of the defendants.
Absolutely.
Which, of course, are concerned to both prosecutors and defense counsel.
Right. No, I'm aware of what their concerns were, Chief, and I'm wondering whether you've had any discussion since or any chance to weigh those concerns or address those concerns. Can we feel comfortable adopting this without further information in that regard?
Well, I have two ways of answering that, Judge.
It's a long question.
I was not privy to the actual conversation that occurred. I have my opinion on that, but the conversation that occurred with the Department of Justice was with Judge McMonagle and Judge Leinweber. So if you want that answer from them, I would have to defer.
That's fine.
I don't mean to dodge a question.
No, but I'd like those concerns addressed so that I can feel comfortable voting on this today.
If I may, I believe that those concerns were addressed and that they are in support of this petition as it is written.
Well, that's why I raised the question as to 2A and the requirements for the defense to agree to things, because I think that is part of that concern. So, fine.
If I've misspoke, judges, understanding is that they are in support of the petition as it is written.
Okay. I have a question. Are you done with yours?
I sure am. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. In looking at subsection 2D, where if an example would be the prosecution was going to have one witness testify by video conferencing, and the defendant objects, it appears to say that the court must honor the objection, but in so doing, the defendant will also have to give up his right to a speedy trial. And I believe that we have upheld the right to a speedy trial under almost all circumstances. Once the defendant requests that, I wonder, have you talked about whether this is really a constitutionally sufficient provision to require the waiver of the speedy trial rule just because the defendant objects to the presentation of a witness at his or her trial?
Well, I'd have to defer that to Judge Leinweber. He's from the legal perspective, he'd be able to answer that question, Justice. I would not be able to effectively answer that for him.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I ask,
Justice Presser.
I'm interested. You gave a list of what you thought the benefits were of video conferencing, such as security was one, case disposition, and then you said health care costs of inmates. That one was not self-evident to me. What does that mean?
When the jails, county jails, bring in when somebody comes from a state institution, they take on the medical responsibilities of these individuals while they are in their care. So they need to process them in. It takes nurse medical time to process them in. They take over their medications and they have to provide, excuse me, Justice, provide that medical care, those prescriptions. Virtually, a majority of the individuals that are in our care have some kind of medical need for prescriptions or treatment. They take over that function and are responsible for that while they're in their care.
Very good.
Any other comments? Thank you, Mr. Nyman.
Thank you.
All right. Judge Leinweber. The Honorable Edward Leinweber, Richland County Circuit Court.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the Supreme Court, good afternoon. It's an honor to have the opportunity to appear before you today in support of Petition 712. In overview, the proposed Supreme Court Rule Chapter 68, Rules on the Use of Video Conferencing in the Court, attempts to do the following. First, provide a clear statement of the Court's intent, the Supreme Court's intent, which should help lawyers, trial judges, and appellate judges in interpreting and applying these rules. Second, establish stringent technical and operational standards which will apply to the use of this technology against a litigant's will, that is, over objection. Third, gives trial judges broad discretion in the use of video conferencing technology when the minimum technical and operational standards are met, and clear guidance in the exercise of their discretion to permit or deny the use of this technology in almost any situation, while allowing judges to deny the use of video conferencing technology in any circumstance, regardless of the guidelines, and giving criminal defendants and respondents in the enumerated statutory types of proceedings the right to be physically present in the courtroom at all critical stages of the proceedings, and giving litigants the right to object to the use of this technology in the presentation of witnesses, especially criminal defendants and respondents in the statutory proceedings, who are given the right to prohibit video presentation of an opponent's witness subject to the waiver of time limits, and permitting, finally, waivers and stipulations to vary these rules in any particular case.
Ms. Leinweber, let me ask you about that. It's a follow-up to Justice Robitaille's question. I've got two questions I want to ask, but I'll ask this one first. The concept of objecting to a video conference sounds very different to me than a waiver of a constitutional right. And I'm wondering, to the extent that the PPAC discussed it in the context of when someone objects video conferencing. They want the witness brought in or they want to be brought in. How that translates to an affirmative waiver of a constitutional right to a speedy trial.
Now, we're talking about the confrontation issue, the objection to a witness, an opponent's witness, being presented via video.
That's one, or their insistence on being present themselves.
Okay. If we could take them one at a time.
Sure.
The first case is the confrontation issue. And, of course, there were two First Deputy Public Defenders, Bill Reddert and Sam Benedict, on our committee, and we enjoy, I think, the support of the Public Defender's Office in advancing the as reflected in the Public Defender's letter to us. The thinking there, there is that there has been no determination that constitutional confrontation rights cannot be sufficiently met in a video presentation of an opponent's witness. If the technical standards of this rule are met, it might well be that a court in a future case might rule that the right to confrontation is met even in the video presentation of an opponent's witness when the cross-examination is via video. So
accepting that proposition is valid, my problem is a different one. How does an objection turn into an affirmative waiver?
Well, the I guess I can only answer that by saying that the alternative could be under a rule that opponents' witnesses can be presented via video and a constitutionally adequate right of cross-examination can be afforded via video. We thought that we were going overboard, essentially, in protecting the right, not testing, if you will, the limits of the use of video conferencing with respect to the confrontation right by simply saying, if you want him here, we'll have him here. But that may require some additional time. So that's about as much as
we can discuss. Let me ask the question slightly differently.
I understand what you're asking. That's really about all I can
say. Let me ask the question a little bit differently. Is there anything within this rule as contemplated that would preclude, say, a request for use of video conferencing from coming earlier in the proceedings so that the question and answer are resolved early enough so that you don't have to impact the right to a speedy trial? In other words, you get the answer early on as opposed to later in the proceedings.
Oh, sure. I mean, if physically producing the witness in the courtroom can be accomplished within the framework, within the time limits of, and we're talking about statutory speedy trial here.
Right.
A judge would certainly do that.
Well, look, doesn't B say that if you, whether it be defense or state, but let's talk about state, wants to produce a witness via video conferencing in an evidentiary hearing, which by definition, if the defendant objects, court can't do it. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you have to give 20 days notice prior to the hearing. So if the state wants to bring in a video conferencing, and the one we talk about that I've met all over the state in my county visits is an expert witness from the state crime lab who's going to testify that the stuff is illegal drugs. And it's usually very short. It's usually without cross-examination, but it's needed as part of the state's case. And because the lab is so backed up and has so few people that can go out and testify, and there are so many cases, it might take weeks or months to get it on the docket. Video conferencing has been suggested across the state by public defender and prosecutors for those kinds of simple expert testimony. So 20 days before the hearing, the state would say, I'm bringing him in by video, right? The defense can object, right?
Right.
In 10 days. And then it would seem to me the court has two ways of handling it. They can bring them in at the regular scheduled hearing, right?
If you can get them there.
Or they're going to have to continue it and set a different trial date, right?
Now, according to your comments, when the defendant says, I don't want it by video conferencing, and this witness has to be brought in, you are saying that that's a motion for a continuance by the defendant.
Well, I understand that concern. And
if that's a motion for a continuance, doesn't the general rule is that if the defendant seeks a continuance, he can't at the same time yell that he hasn't had a speedy trial?
Yep.
So, I mean, that's how I understood that it's an effective.
And again, we're talking about this is statutory speedy trial, 97110 or whatever it is. It is not a constitutional right to speedy trial, which generally you hold that motion, you try the case, you see whether the passage of time has had any prejudicial effect on the defendant's right to a fair trial, and then you rule on that constitutional speedy trial motion. So since it's just a since it's a statutory right to be tried within a certain time period, I don't see the constitutional issue being squarely raised here. You had also asked Justice Butler about the right to be physically present, and that's clearly in critical stages of the proceeding, as we now understand them, as they may develop in case law, the defendant, respondent, is entitled to be there at critical stages of the proceeding. So, yes, we might do an initial appearance. Yes, we might do a bail hearing. If he or she were to object in those circumstances, then the court exercises discretion through use of the criteria that's expressed in the rule. But if a defendant respondent wants to be present for a critical stage of the proceeding, he or she must be brought.
Let me ask just one other question. With respect to 6805 sub 1 and 6802 sub G, is the absence of the mention of Chapter 980 that's been referenced by Rate DeFora, is that something that was not contemplated by the committee, or is that something that was looked at and specifically worked out?
No, it was not contemplated. It was totally inadvertently omitted, and as soon as someone mentioned it, both the PD's
well, agree it should go in.
We said that makes sense.
All right.
So I would propose to include it.
What would you propose? Tell me exactly what you're proposing.
Okay. Let me say also that this rule, this draft, has probably been read by dozens of lawyers and judges. When I hadn't read it in a while, when I was preparing for this presentation, I read it. I see three drafting errors in it. So at some point, I'd like to address those. But are you asking, Chief Justice, where would we put in the 980? It would be in, in the contents at the beginning of the proposed chapter, where it says 6805, use in criminal and delinquency proceedings. That survives from an earlier draft. It should say criminal and chapter 48, 51, 55, okay. 938, and 980 right. Proceedings. Mm-hmm. There should be a 68.07 in the context.
You'd add 982 now, I guess.
980, also correct. Section 6802,
it would be G.
980 G. Goes in that litany. Anywhere where you see the litany of the statutory special
right.
Proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
6805 sub 1, or the actually the section title, and then later in the body of
right,
subsection
got it.
1. I think that's it.
Now, do C and D of 6805-2, do C and D refer to B? Is that what we're talking about?
6805, sub.
Yeah. C
section.
And D.
C and D. Plaintiff or petitioner.
Made by the plaintiff. Is that a motion under B? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. An objection.
Is it a notion?
Yes.
Is
if,
it a proponent? Is it a notion of intent to present?
It's the objection.
The objection.
I understand what C and D refer to.
What we're saying here is if the so you're in a under 6805 sub 2, you're in a criminal case or one of the proceedings under the enumerated statute chapters there. That's the type of case it is.
Right, okay.
In this case, the respondent or defendant wants to call a witness by video. The petitioner objects.
Okay,
in this
so that
case,
refers
the county
to
or the state or whatever. Petitioner objects. That isn't a blanket, okay, bring the witness in. That's a situation in which the court must exercise its discretion under the enumerated criteria of 6803 and decide whether to permit that by video over the plaintiff's petitioner's objection or whether to grant the objection and require that the witness be brought in. The defendant respondent has additional rights because of the confrontation issue.
971.10, which is what I think is the statutory speedy trial, sub 3 talks about granting continuance. The judge has to just do it on the record and explain what's happening. But can postpone it from the 60 days misdemeanor or 90 days felony, which is what I think that the comment is referring to.
Mm-hmm. It works that way.
Okay.
In your capacity as a member of the Judicial Council, I seem to recall that you did some study of 751.12.
Right.
And 751.12.1 is the basic rulemaking authority of the court. And in that, there is a sentence: the rules shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify the substantive rights of any litigant.
Right.
Are you confident that this proposal does not abridge, enlarge, or modify the substantive rights of any litigant?
Looking back 10 years from now, I'll be more confident, but I think that I'm quite confident. For instance, when we're talking about critical stages of the proceeding, we try to make it clear that I think in the comment to that I say critical stages of the proceeding is not defined under the section but incorporates existing law as well as law as it adopted or decided. Says it is intended merely to preserve such rights and to avoid abrogating by virtue of this adoption of this chapter any such rights. We're trying to address it totally in the procedural context. I can't see where any what we would call substantive rights, which could be gray in some situations, I can't see where anything I would call a substantive right is granted or denied by virtue of this rule.
Counselor, the Attorney General's first letter of December 18th was concerned whether there had been any investigation about whether people, witnesses in a court proceeding, tended to be more truthful when they appeared in person before the judicial tribunal than when they appeared by video conferencing. And I'm wondering, did you have an opportunity to discuss this on your committee?
We didn't discuss that directly, but let me address that. But also, if I may, the comments on the Attorney General's comments in the letter.
Mm-hmm.
One of the decisional criteria in 6803 talks about, and I'll have to quickly skim it to find it, talks about that issue. Let me just take a moment. Subsection E, 6803, subsection E. This is a decisional criteria the trial court would look at in weighing its discretion. The importance of the witness being personally present in the courtroom, where the dignity, solemnity, and decorum of the surroundings will impress upon the witness the duty to testify truthfully. I must confess, as a trial judge, to not being real excited about telephone testimony all the time because of that very concern. Also, the almost virtual mm-hmm. inability to follow up with a perjury prosecution in the event of a problem. So I think that that is a consideration. So if credibility were a substantial issue with respect to a witness and cross-examination thought to be especially critical, as opposed to the state lab hygiene person, That might be a reason weighing in the trial judge's exercise of discretion to requiring that person to come. But I'm not aware, I think Mr. Tepora in the letter says he's not, and we're not aware of any studies that have tried to document that in any sense. The other thing I'd like to say, with all due respect, with regard to the Attorney General's letter, that suggests initially that we be careful in the introduction to the use of video conferencing technology in the criminal arena. Well, Mr. Nyman just said that 90% of the county jails in this state have video conferencing. Every prison has video conferencing. The mental health facilities that were conducting these 51 proceedings have video conferencing. 968.07 already authorizes the court to use live audiovisual means in various criminal hearings. So that train left the station a long time ago with regard to the use of video conferencing in criminal proceedings. So we understand it's a caution, and we've tried to address that very directly in several ways by just saying, fine, you can be here if it's a critical stage of the proceeding. We're not even going to deal with video conferencing. If you want a witness here to cross-examine in person, fine, we'll bring them here. So I think that we have been cautious about the use of this technology in criminal proceedings and have carefully addressed that.
Are you aware of any research that's been done on the effectiveness of testimony on a jury's decision-making when it's presented by video conferencing rather than in person?
I'm not aware of any research, but I feel just sort of based on my experience that would be a potential area of concern. It is another decisional criteria, 6803 sub H, whether the participation of an individual, this is again a criteria the judge uses in deciding whether to permit video for the presentation of a witness, whether the participation of an individual from a remote location presents such person in a diminished or distorted sense such that it negatively reflects upon such individual to persons present in the courtroom, including the jury.
I wasn't so much thinking about negatively affects as, it's kind of like going to a concert. They now are actually simulcasting opera, which is wonderful. But if you go to a concert and you see it on public television, which is where I tend to see some things late at night, it's very different than sitting in the concert hall. I mean, it's wonderful, but it's very, very different. And I think the effect of a live witness on a jury's decision-making capacities can't help but have some variance. And if it's something the court is to consider, I'm not sure how the court is going to, quote, consider it, because if you think it ever affects the jury in a case, I don't see how you cannot have the witness there.
I guess I would do it this way, I'm trying to think of. I would not be particularly worried about it if it's the state lab of hygiene chemist.
Uh-huh.
I would be more worried about it. I'm not sure I've got the parties in the right context, but I would be more worried about it if it was the defendant's alibi witness.
Sure.
So you're saying
there's sometimes you wouldn't allow it when you say you'd be more worried about it, and other times when you probably would because it was something that was just needed for foundational information in the trial? Is that?
Yeah. Okay. I would be sensitive to it in every discretionary ruling made where there's an objection to the video presentation.
Uh-huh.
In some settings that we're exploring, it would be much more prominent concern than in others.
Judge Lineweber? I'd like to follow up Justice Prosser's earlier question, because there's something that still concerns me about the last sentence in the third paragraph of the comment.
Which comments to which section?
Comments to 6805. And let me present this scenario. Justice Prosser invokes his right to a statutory speedy trial. Justice Bradley is prosecuting. She wants to bring in... I was scared if I did that, I might go there. Justice Bradley wants to bring in a witness by way of video conferencing. Justice Prosser objects. Now, it's one thing to look at 971.10 sub 3 and say that Justice Bradley, as the proponent of bringing in this video testimony, is moving for continuance, and I am the judge. I'm going to determine whether or not the ends of justice will be served by taking this action. It's another thing altogether to say, Justice Prosser, even though Justice Bradley wants to bring in the evidence, you are waiving your right to a statutory speedy trial, and then that gets you back to 7051.12(1). And that's the concern that I have, is whether or not that is impacting on the defendant's statutory rights.
And it would be a substantive right, I think.
Substantive right, exactly.
Just speedy trial, I mean, that's gray area verging into substantive, perhaps. So that's a good point.
And I'm not sure the rule presents the problem as much as that comment. But that sentence in that comment concerns me.
Judge Leinweber, do you think if taking a look at the rule under sub D, the part where it starts with however?
I'm sorry, I'm still not with you.
Sub D in your rule, in the rule?
Yep. Yes,
D as well, that's true.
And then it's however, such objection may constitute a motion for continuance and a waiver of any speedy trial demand or other time limits for such reasonable time as the court determines to be necessary to produce the witness physically in the courtroom, and the court shall make the appropriate findings under 971.10 sub 3, so that a judge knew, you know, it's not the end of the analysis, it's not the waiver, you actually have to go and make those findings on the record, because the court can do the motion on its own or by that of a party under the statute, so then that would perhaps cure the dilemma raised here.
I think it's an excellent idea to put in the reference to 971.10 to make it clear we're talking about a statutory right and not the constitutional speedy trial right.
It needs a little more than just the reference. It needs a little tinkering with that language.
And the other suggestion is to say may constitute rather than shall.
May instead of shall. And then just at the end of that sentence, and this isn't perfect, but something like, and the court shall make the appropriate findings under 971.10 sub 3. Because then it directs the court to the statute and the criteria they have to follow and use. And I think it might cover that concern. Then the waiver part, the specific waiver would be out, because that constitutes maybe an affirmative act on the part of a defendant when this isn't necessarily an affirmative waiver, which I think is what most people think of when they think of waiver. Mm-hmm. That might be where people are caught up here.
Mr. Leinweber, or Judge Leinweber, Mr. Nyman passed off my question to you. I haven't heard an answer. And my concern is this, and I don't want you to go through every concern expressed by the Department of Justice through Mr. Tacora's letter, but it sounded to me as if there have been some further discussions and perhaps negotiations. Are you satisfied that this rule addresses his concerns and the concerns of the Department of Justice?
The short answer is yes, if I could elaborate a little bit on the short answer. Assistant Attorney General Greg Weber was a member of our committee. He was invited. He was on judicial counsel, and we were talking about video conferencing. We invited him to join the committee, and he kindly did that. He was always concerned about potential impact on constitutional rights of defendants and respondents and certain types of proceedings. And his contribution in that regard was extremely valuable. The folks in the Public Defender's Office were also very concerned about these same things. A lot of what you see reflected in the final product, which is a product of 18 months of ruminating back and forth in meetings on these issues, this rule is a final product. I think it's safe to say that the public defender constituency is, I think, pretty pleased with the rule, as reflected by the letter from Mr. Chikaris. I'm not sure, and again, with all due respect to the department, I'm not sure to what extent Mr. Tafora was actually apprised of what we had been going through at the time that the letter was written. When we saw the letter reflected in the clerk's file and initiated the phone contact, I think we diffused those things mostly. And I don't want to say that there certainly are legitimate concerns. I think we've diffused those mostly. It's basically confrontation and right to be physically present, which we've given a flat-out right to be here if you choose to be here. The other thing, of course, is that letter, even the follow-up letter and the phone conversation was before the Supreme Court's decision released yesterday in the Van Patten decision. Now, you know, you can read too much or too little into that whole Van Patten thing. It wasn't a video conferencing case. It was really a federal habeas case. You can do all of that. But to the extent that was a concern also, that contributed to the concern of the AG, certainly that has to be partially lessened as well. Courts I haven't seen a lot. Our court, other courts haven't. I haven't seen a U.S. Supreme Court from the sound of it. Hasn't developed a lot of case law on the extent to which audiovisual, not just telephone, but audiovisual technology can be used in conformance with the constitutional rights of litigants. So we're all cautious as we develop that.
One thing that I noticed was absent from your rule is that the person who wants to put a witness forward by video conferencing just has to give notice they want to do that. Do you think it might be more appropriate to have them say why they are requesting it? In other words, it, you know, is just because it's cheaper, is that a valid reason for doing it? Just because the guy doesn't want to travel to Madison from Oshkosh in its wintertime, is that a reason for doing it?
Well,
I'm concerned that it's very open-ended.
Although what?
It's very open-ended. I mean, you can say you're going to do it for any reason, and the other guy then has to object.
And there's, it's no doubt that another of the basic concepts of this rule is to that it be open-ended, that it let the use of video conferencing develop subject to these decisional criteria and these absolute kind of vetoes in some cases. I guess, Justice Rogenczyk, what I would say there is that if there's a problem, the other side will object and will have the hearing and make the determination, exercise discretion under the decisional criteria, make the determination. And, of course, cost and inconvenience and all those things are part of the criteria that are listed. If there's no objection.
But what if one person's pro se? Or what if both people are pro se? And you've got people wanting to present things by video conferencing. I mean, pro se has got to be hard enough for a trial judge when everybody's standing right in front of the court.
Well, I can think of the two different poses I take in that situation on the trial bench. On the one hand, they say, you understand that you're going to be governed by the same rules of procedure and substantive law, et cetera, that anybody else.
But they don't know what they are.
And the other thing I would probably do is lean over the bench to a certain extent and say, do you have any problem with this video witness? And outside of accommodating things in that way, I'm not sure how else that we can do it. The other thing I would say that, you know, in a bigger sense, I'd rather have everybody present in my courtroom. I'd rather not mess with the phones and the video conferencing and all. I'd rather just have everybody there, like we're all here.
But a lot of people who are pro se would prefer that they take up their small claims case with a telephone conference call than stopping work that day,
absolutely,
traveling to the courthouse and killing a whole day and a whole day's salary.
Right.
I mean, that's telephone, but you really have the same thing on video conferencing, that they can bring in a tape of the auto mechanic, and if that will pass muster.
Small claims, you might.
Small claims.
Do that. So I think that in a greater sense,
that's where you're most apt to get a self-represented person in a civil case,
or
family or civil family or small claims.
We're extending the reach of the courtroom, the access to the courtroom, the efficiency of decision-making proceedings, trying to minimize expense by embracing this technology, which I, you know, fully support doing. But it does introduce a level of complexity, I guess, that in a simpler, earlier age we didn't have to deal with. I think that the technology is advancing in a way that makes it pretty user-friendly, and it's a net good to what we're trying to accomplish in our system of courts.
One of the things, go ahead, just spread.
I have a question concerning the
Van Patten case that you referenced earlier. And I need you to allay my fears. My fear emanates from my belief that the question of whether a defendant has a constitutional right to have his attorney present at critical stages of the proceeding is yet an open question, I think. I think that there is no definitive answer to that. Not that I have researched this. I'm paraphrasing Justice Stevens and hope that he had his many law clerks research that. But I
believe... Present in court.
Present in court, yes.
Because you do have a constitutional right to have counsel at every critical stage. The question is...
And indeed, and that's the point he makes. In 1984, when the Cronic decision was issued, and they said, you have the right to have an attorney present at all critical stages of the proceeding, he said, who thought in 1984 that we'd be doing things like this? And we didn't need to put in open court. He said, okay, so we don't have those words in the 1984 Cronic case, but that's what those words mean. And three judges from the U.S. Court of Appeals thought that's what Cronic meant, that you have a constitutional right to have your attorney present in open court at all critical stages of the proceeding. Now, as I, see it, I can be wrong, but as I see it, that question is unresolved. The way that they resolved Van Patten, as we often do in the law, we come in through a different channel. He said, aha, this is a habeas case. This case is habeas, and so the standard that we have to address is whether or not that the state court's decision was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. There's no clearly established federal law on the issue of whether or not a defendant has a right to have an attorney present in open court. And so, therefore, you're out of luck. Van Patten, habeas, So that's the way that I read it. Correct me. Allay my fears, because my fears are, if this is still an unanswered question, then then we might have a lot coming back to haunt us later on, because the only thing you talk about here is in 6805-2 that the defendant is entitled to be physically present in the courtroom, but you don't make any comments about whether or not he has the right to have his attorney physically present in the courtroom. So, help me with that if you can.
Well, I think that, first of all, you're certainly right in your reading of the Van Patten case and Justice Stevens' concurrence. My guess is that as case law develops, when courts are looking at whether or not that right's been met, if the person isn't actually physically present standing next to the client, the lawyer isn't actually physically present standing next to the client in the courtroom, then the courts are going to look at to what extent was it the functional equivalent of that. If we can imagine a situation in which there's absolutely no functional difference, there would be not much of a principled decision to say that that didn't meet the right. So it's going to be things like how the quality of the video and audio, the ability to confer privately, the ability of the lawyer to read the nuance and the things that were discussed in the Van Patten case. You know, is your client having second thoughts? Does it look like he would like to step aside and confer? If we could envision a technologically produced scenario that provides all of that, my guess is that courts in the future will rule that meets the bill.
Maybe, but maybe not. I think there is one justice who's already tipped his... What do? You tip your hand or you tip your hat, grab your hat and take your coat? I'm not sure what you tip.
All right.
One justice, I know how he's going to vote because he's already said how he's going to vote. He said he would agree with the decision of the unanimous Seventh Circuit, the three judges on the Seventh Circuit, the first time they had it around. So I don't know how the other ones would vote on it, but That causes me concern.
The second thing about that, Justice Bradley, that I would say is that haven't we, in a sense, and this is certainly a scenario I don't recall having discussed anyway, but haven't we addressed that in part by saying that, or at least I think we've addressed that in part by saying that the defendant respondent has a flat-out right to be there physically present. We just,
him,
I guess, assume.
Him or herself, but nothing about the attorney.
I guess best I think I can say, to the extent we touched upon that at all, is we just sort of assume we got the defendant respondent there, we're going to have the lawyer there, so we didn't really address that concern. We didn't, I don't think we, Mike or Cliff McMonagle, if I'm spacing out, let me know, but I don't think we specifically address the situation, I guess, as you see in Van Patten, where the lawyer was the guy off on the telephone.
But in Van Patten, Judge Evans wrote, he just didn't have a lawyer. He didn't have a lawyer at all, wherever the lawyer was, because they could not communicate with each other privately.
Viewed it as the chronic structural defect issue.
Yes. He didn't have, that's what he says. In his opinion for a unanimous panel, Evans explained at length why the defendant had not had the assistance of counsel at a critical stage, the plea hearing, because there was no communication possible. So there was a total absence
of counsel.
Well,
they were on the telephone.
I know, but it was open line. He could not communicate in private. Therefore, he had no counsel.
I actually see the opposite as possibly happening, where someone could say, you know, I could have had my hearing a month ago, and I wouldn't be sitting here today. You should have conducted this by video conference. You should have told me about that. And instead, I sit here in prison. You know, I think people could weigh in the opposite way as well and wish that they had the benefit of video conferencing, and it's not used for some reason.
We actually, I think, see in practice what I'm seeing in the year or 18 months that I've used it, video conferencing actively in my court, I think Mike has seen is that that's actually the fact. People would prefer to litigants, incarcerated litigants, institutionalized litigants, for the most part, like the idea of video conferencing as opposed to the ride in the squad car, 3 days in the county jail in the case of the inmate,
In your practice, Judge Lineweber, when you've used video conferencing, is the attorney present in the courtroom with you, or is the attorney present at the institution with the defendant?
Most of what we're seeing are video bail hearings with our jail. Nine of those for every one otherwise, and then most of the...
I don't think the bail hearings would be considered critical. So I'm thinking about some of the more serious proceedings that might take place. Say an inmate or you have a person out at one of the mental health facilities. At one of the mental health facilities,
yep.
And appears by video conference. And I've been part of a video conferencing when I was a circuit judge and as a municipal judge. And I know some of the times we used to have the attorneys in the courtroom, but the defendants would be in the institution. Sometimes the attorneys would be at the institution along with the defendants. And I'm just wondering from your experience, when you have things other than, say, bail hearings, when you have any type of proceeding that involves a little bit more, that's close to a critical stage.
Some are going to be probable cause hearings and
sure.
Chapter 51 proceedings.
Right.
And in most of those circumstances, I would say that the attorney is present in the courtroom, the litigants in the hospital or institution.
And how do the two communicate during the course of the proceeding as the proceedings take place?
They communicate ahead of time. They could, either by personal visit or, I mean, I don't know how the attorney discharges that obligation in all cases, but communicate ahead of time. I haven't been asked to, but I would, of course, take a recess. What's unique about those hearings, mostly, those folks are, for the most part, non-communicative or at least not rational. So that's maybe a little odder situation. I would have to say, I consider myself still kind of a newbie in the use of this equipment, although it's now been well over a year, and we've used it pretty aggressively. We have not, I can't think of a you know, significant hearing. I haven't done a suppression hearing where the guys in the prison and the attorneys here or anything like that. So
you're basically using them for minor hearings, scheduling conferences, things of that nature.
In terms of the litigant being at a distance, yes. A lot of witness testimony. More witness testimony, I would say.
I'm sort of curious about that. You don't use them for mental commitment hearings? Because I would think that'd be a really great way to use this technique, because instead of the people coming through the public hallways in shackles, they can...
Probable cause hearings in mental commitment proceedings. I can't actually think of a final hearing that's gone to trial as a contested matter since we've had it.
But you would consider it at a final hearing?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me just ask either one of you a question. And that is, this is in Chapter 68 of the SCRs. I was surprised when I saw that. I left to my own devices. I would have put it in one of the other... that is substantive in the regular statute book under 751.12. And maybe it's too hard to do because you'd have to separate civil versus criminal, but I still think that's where I would have put it because I think that's where people will look for it. And that's where audio conferencing is. It's in the statute book. So I want to know why you put it in 68 and not in the statute book.
Why we are doing this by rule versus a legislation?
Yeah, but we do, things are in the statute book that are by rule. 801, I think, 801 is, I think the whole chapter is adopted by rule.
We only discussed rule versus legislation.
Yeah, but you don't care where it is. Okay, but you see what's bothering me about this because...
Yes.
People are not too accustomed.
We're up here because I think we are getting into areas where perhaps anecdotal experiences are becoming the subject of discussion. I've had more experience probably than Ed, and I've been at this a lot longer and have heard anecdotes from a much wider range. One of the things that I can say we are experiencing here in this hearing is exactly what our committee struggled with for its 18 months, and that is, if you mention video conferencing and you mention proceedings, every person around a table or in a room is going to have a different mental picture of what it is we're talking about. If you happen to be a civil lawyer, you're thinking, gee, maybe I can take depositions, or I can call a witness from San Francisco that I'd have to pay to fly here. If you are talking about a criminal proceeding, one person's thinking about a bail hearing and thinks, hey, this is a real simple way to save time. The next person's thinking about a jury trial. So our committee, in trying to reach a static starting point, basically said, let's not all have a different concept in mind at the same time. Video conferencing, and the reason the rule is one that encourages use rather than specifically says, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, is because we are depending heavily on the collective wisdom of the trial bench in trying to assess in advance when a video conferencing use would be appropriate and when a video conferencing use might be pushing the envelope. We expect those where the envelope is going to be pushed will be circumstances that all of you and the appellate courts before you will likely see and address. But we are talking about, as Mike Nyman has pointed out, the 90% of things. We are talking about no-brainers, if you will. We are talking about the use of video conferencing that saves court time, law enforcement time, addresses court security, and many other things that we have not mentioned during this hearing. The concept of use of video conferencing starts with what we have touched upon here, and that is we start with the presumption that everybody's supposed to be in the room together as the traditional court proceeding is. And we have made inroads over the last quarter century with a telephone. And we've pushed the envelope on that, and it has, by and large, worked pretty well. For the last 10 years, we have been doing the same thing with video conferencing. We have been making participation easier. And in fact, with video conferencing, we've certainly made it much fuller experience than with telephones. And as the FedEx Kinkos around the country continue to offer video conferencing services, as law offices do, and we hope someday possibly even public defender's offices start to be given the equipment, we will see greater efficiencies. Comment was made about the position of the Department of Justice and the supplemental report. Their supplemental letter was softening because they recognized that perhaps by saying we shouldn't have this rule, we should wait around and see what other states would do, isn't simply the Wisconsin way. But we have been the leader, not the follower, and I think they recognized that after we had a little discussion last week. The Attorney General's office is also responsible for protecting the constitutional integrity of the laws of Wisconsin. To ask the Attorney General's office to come forward and say, we think this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, no problem at all, we support it fully, might compromise their ability to stand at this same very podium and say, oops, we said that back then, but now this is now, and we're a little embarrassed about it. The concept of video conferencing is here. The rule is proposed to make it more useful. There was a question about studies. Justice Rogensack, you raised that issue. Mike Nyman, who would prefer to probably say this, but I will read it in the interest of expediency. He had notes that had he been asked the question, he would have responded. Virtual presence study, his notes. None recently have been done, none in the criminal field. However, two separate studies by Kelly Shaver were conducted in a civil trial using a witness that was in the courtroom and then not. No statistical difference on the outcome. All articles point to conclusion that video conferencing is perceived as reality. 14 appellate judges in a study by federal courts. Nothing occurred using video that impaired their understanding of the legal issues. It provided flexibility, saved travel time, and provided access. Video conferencing testimony was also used in court-martial proceedings.
Do you have cites for me on any of those
articles?
I have
to defer to Mr. Nyman on
okay,
that.
Okay, I can see him later. About
his summary notes. But that's why we asked Mike to participate in this, because he's been doing the in trenches, this is what's happening around the country kind of information. And he has reassured us throughout our investigation and throughout the development of this rule, what we all believe. It's developing, and there are studies being done, and thus far nothing has jumped out at us saying, hey, wait a minute, folks, this just doesn't work.
Well, it's the younger generation, if it's not on video, doesn't believe it.
Yeah, that's right.
From now on, so accustomed to video, they don't think that if you're in person, you're for real or worth listening to.
We have had, in our studies at various stages, we have had representatives from the Department of Corrections and more specifically from the institutions such as Mendota and Winnebago. They have routinely reported that persons asked if they wish to be in person or wish to appear virtually by video conferencing have overwhelmingly said, let me do it by video, because the hassle of being processed in and out of a state prison institution or the disruption of somebody suffering from a mental illness or the disruption in their life already has been a major factor. And these all blend. But it comes back down to the judge being asked to use it. In the trainings, we have all said to the judges, make sure, first of all, that the equipment works. We all ask the person on the far side, can you hear us? Can you see us? Is the video quality good? We also say that if at any point you wish to interrupt, wave your hand, or say something, just as you would in the courtroom, bearing in mind the respect that we're all entitled and the order that we're trying to keep. So we make it as interactive as we possibly can. Justice Bradley, you asked about pleas. Now, I think with Van Patten having been pending and the uncertainties of that, a judge who would be lunging forward to take a plea with the attorney here and the defendant elsewhere would be potentially doing some dangerous plowing absent a colloquy with the parties as to whether or not this is acceptable and things to soften or possibly create a waiver. In my experience, I have done many proceedings with the Cheetah. We did one a couple of weeks ago, anecdote, if you will. We had a lady who was already in Tichita who was facing a bad check charge in Greenlight County that was relatively insignificant in the overall scheme of things. Rather than bringing her in for an initial appearance, we put her on video, mainly to do the initial appearance. She said, I just want to plea and get this over with. I'm in here for 2 years or whatever it was, and I just want to get this over with. Well, I went through the colloquy with her about the waiver of counsel. I went through the issues about the quality of the video. And basically, when you have an unrepresented person who satisfies the test of waiver of counsel, video can actually be a whole lot better, because oftentimes you can see the person better on video than you could if the person were sitting at a distant counsel table, in terms of the court being able to observe the interaction of and the personal aspects that we are supposed to observe in the nonverbal world. So there are many things, if we got into the anecdotes, that would support why this is something that needs to be done, why it's already here. We're trying to give some guidance in bringing our arms around something that is growing beyond our control at the moment, and why this is a proactive rule, not a restrictive rule. And I stand to ask or answer any more questions if I can.
Any other questions of either Judge Lineweaver or McMonagle? Justice Prosser.
Judge McMonagle, you headed off the question that I might have asked about why this is a rule rather than legislation. I think the Chief Justice has made a stellar point in suggesting this ought to be a rule in the heart of the procedure of the statutes rather than a Supreme Court rule.
And that rather is, than an SCR.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is certainly acceptable under 751.12. However, there's a little tension for me. This court clearly has the power to make rules, pleading practice, and procedure. There can be no dispute about that. But the statutory authority, when we rely on 751.12, says explicitly, the rule shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify the substantive rights of any litigant. And if there's any question about that, it seems to me that question goes away when legislation is passed, unless there's something constitutional that cannot be abridged, let us say. So let me go back and ask this question. Was there any discussion with legislators, or is there any contemplation that there would be a problem in the legislature if you have the support of the public defenders and the Bar Association? And I think at least now, much less concern from the Department of Justice.
I think Mike Nyman could confirm that early in our process, there were one or more legislators who were willing to take up the issue and to propose legislation. Early in the committee's debate, we discussed which format. And we would like to think that our committee opted to come the rule route, not because we felt more comfortable in this environment than in the other end of the building, but rather felt that because this was relatively new, that it was something that was not restrictive, that we would be safer exploring its use as a court rule versus a piece of legislation that would be carved in harder granite than a court rule. So I think that's the perhaps sheepish response to your question.
Well, I'm sort of trying to think of what substantive rights we're talking about. I don't know. Do we have a substantive right in a civil case to have every witness present?
Are you asking?
If I could respond to that.
Sure, go ahead.
When Judge Lineweber was in a colloquy with someone up here, I think you alluded to the fact that these speedy trial rights are statutory that we're talking about, not constitutional. Well, the substantive rights here, it seems to be, can be statutory.
Certainly.
Yes, sure. And there might be other things. And the same kind of consideration, with all due respect, applies to the earlier hearing, 7-11. If there are any questions about substantive rights being abridged, they would disappear if there were legislation, given the language of 751-12.
Mr. Prosser, if I may.
I think this is an excellent petition. I'm generally supportive of it. It's a long time in coming. I know that. But it would be nice, I think it would be nice if this was a legislative enactment, too.
My concern, I guess, if I may, and maybe it's a unfounded concern, but this is a very delicate compromise piece of work that took some considerable amount of work to arrive at and time to arrive at. If it sails through the legislature unchanged, I don't see that as a big deal. If it got reworked in the legislature and started unwinding the compromise that we very carefully tried to work towards, then support for whatever might emerge might fracture as well.
I noticed that 807.13, which is telephone and audiovisual, was adopted by court rule. And then in 91 and 99, amended by legislative enactment. I didn't go back to look and see what the amendments. So both the legislature and the judiciary, with us starting this, that dealt with civil plus 48, 51, 54, 55 proceedings. So I think that is of historical interest.
That hadn't gone unnoticed by our committee.
Pardon me?
That hadn't gone unnoticed because we felt that possibly if we could start with a rule, obtain some comfort that it could have been addressed legislatively at a later date.
I do have a, I think the issue raised by the court as to 971.10 is a good one, but can be handled by modification of the language maybe, but that's of interest. Okay. Justice Press, do you have any follow-up on that? Anyone else? Are you?
I'm fine.
You're fine. Okay. Judge Lina Weber.
If I may, just two final points. 968.07, which is sort of a counterpart in the criminal procedure, was also concerning use of telephones and live audiovisual means in various enumerated hearings. I think it was also initially by Supreme Court rule.
Yeah, I had just checked out 807.13. Thank you. That's 968.07?
967.08.
08, right.
The last thing I wanted to say, there were two more drafting glitches, which if you want to note now, or I can submit in some other way.
Give it to us fast.
The word legislation appears at one place in the rule. It's 968.03 in the comment section. That predated the decision to go through. It should say these rules rather than this legislation.
Okay.
And then finally, if you look at the bottom of 6802 sub A, it says, if applicable, there must be a means by which documents can be transmitted between the courtroom and a remote location. That same sentence appears, almost the same sentence, as 6802 sub F. And I can only say that's the product of a draft by committee.
We're familiar with that problem, counsel.
I think that it should, sub F should be the sentence. It should say, if applicable, there must be a means by which, and then that sentence in 6802 sub A should be deleted.
Well, one of the other issues that was raised by somebody was that although you have a provision relating to audio in your rule, it really, somebody wrote that it's just not good enough and that there may be a tension between the audio rule and the video conferencing rule because of some of the language in the audio rule, which seems to cover more than audio. You know what I'm talking about?
6807 is a section on applicability. What we've attempted to do is to say this rule addresses video conferencing technology. Any other statute or rule that authorizes the use of a telephone remains.
Right, but if the other rules govern video, then this rule supersedes it, is what you're trying to say. Okay, thank you. Any other comments or questions? I want to thank both judges for appearing and doing our double whammy on the court. And we'll now hear from Sarah Diedrich here. Diedrich, representing the Wisconsin Counties Association, we have your letter.
Yes. Good. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today with regard to Petition 712, which addresses video conferencing use in the courts. Again, my name is Sarah Diedrich-Kassorf. I'm a senior legislative associate with the Wisconsin Counties Association, and I'm here to discuss very, very briefly the two changes the Wisconsin Counties Association recommended in its written comments on December 11th. Before I address our two changes, I would like to reiterate WCA's position on the use of video conferencing in the courts. WCA has a history of supporting and expanded use of video conferencing in the state of Wisconsin, and our board of directors included in its recent legislative platform a statement supporting statutory changes to allow increased use of video conferencing in the courts. The two changes we are recommending should in no way detract from our support of video conferencing, nor should they be viewed as an obstruction to the adoption of this rule. Rather, our recommended changes are meant just to provide clarification to what we believe is the intent of the authors of the petition and to ensure that the intent cannot be misinterpreted in the future by a member of the judiciary, county board members, or other partners in the state court system. Our first recommended change provides county government with an assurance that members of the judiciary will not have the authority to order the use of video conferencing in counties that have not acquired video conferencing equipment that meets the standards. Section 6801 of the petition states, further, it is the intent of the Supreme Court that judges be vested with the discretion to determine the manner and extent of the use of video conferencing technology, except as specifically set forth in this chapter. WCA respectfully requests that language be added to this section so it reads as follows. Further, it is the intent of the Supreme Court that judges be vested with the discretion to determine the manner and extent of the use of video conferencing technology to the extent such video conferencing technology is available within the county, except as specifically set forth in this chapter. While the use of video conferencing has many benefits to counties in the court system, many counties do not have the fiscal capacity, especially in light of state-imposed levy limits, to acquire video conferencing equipment at this time. Addition of this or similar language will provide some protection that this rule cannot be interpreted as a mandate on county government, which we understand is the author's intent. The second change we propose in our written comments...
Hey, I'm just going to interrupt you. My understanding from communications from the committee is that they agree with you, that this is not a mandate to the counties. It has to be done through the usual procedures of going to the county board and getting funding.
Correct. It's just our reading of this is that it's not exactly clear that that's, we understand that's what the intent is. We just want it to be clear in the actual rule.
Not a problem.
Okay. Thank you. The second change we propose in our written comments asks for the addition of language requiring judges to work with county officials in their respective counties to develop a strategy for increasing the use of video conferencing, taking into consideration the technical and fiscal limitations of the county. Since submitting our written comments, we have had a conversation with Judge McMonigal on our use of the word use within our written comments. And we understand that use versus acquisition do mean two different things. However, again, we do want to ensure that judges and county boards work together if video conferencing is to be utilized in the courtroom. And therefore, we do ask, again, for some additional clarifying language that says that if it is the intent of the judiciary and chief elected official in a county to provide for the use of video conferencing, that the parties shall work in partnership on the acquisition of video conferencing technology, taking into consideration the technical and fiscal limitations of the county. Again, our requests are just meant to clarify the language that is included in 6801 on the intent of the use of video conferencing in the court, and we would like to have our county officials working in partnership with the judiciary on video conferencing.
Ms. Diedrich, it seems to me, and I'll ask the question, and I don't know if you've thought about this before, but it seems to me that, with respect to the second point you made, that there's a perhaps a party that's missing that should be part of your proposal. You talk about the judges working with the county executive and or county board chair, but it seems to me that one of the county officials who's going to be most interested in video conferencing is going to be the county sheriff. Was there an intent to exclude the sheriff from this this proposal, or should they be included in the discussion, or was that contemplated at all?
Oh, it's just an oversight. Absolutely, we believe that all parties involved at the local level be a part of these discussions and the conversation, and by no means did we mean to exclude the sheriff.
As a follow-up, and when I read your letter initially, I paused a bit too, because oftentimes by naming two entities, you're excluding others, as was just evidenced by the question of Justice Butler. I'm wondering if the language should be more in the vein of judges shall work in their respective counties to develop a strategy for increasing the use, as opposed to denominating right. All the people. You know, once you get to the sheriffs, what about the state public defender? You know, all the people that have come together in the counties or in the state to put this together. So would you have objection to kind of making the language more inclusive as opposed to just identifying two entities?
Absolutely not. We would have no objection to that whatsoever. That's all I have for this afternoon.
Thank you very much. And on behalf of the court, Ms. Diedrich, I want to thank the County Association for all their work in cooperation and video conferencing. They were part of the original reports on video conferencing starting in the 90s and have worked with the local county boards and sheriffs in providing video conferencing, as you very well know. So we have appreciated this is with another example of cooperation and collaboration among many.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and please send that word to your board and your director. Sheriff Dryden, you've been very patient. Washburn County.
Chief Justice, Justice of the Supreme Court, thank you very much. This is truly a humbling experience. Not many opportunities for a small county sheriff from northern Wisconsin to stand before you folks. I've been in this room twice. This is the second time. I don't want to limb here and tell you that a lot of sheriffs don't necessarily always agree with opinions coming off of the court.
We are shocked, Sheriff. Just
the
Kleinschmidt shocked.
Kleinschmidt one right. I was here during the Kleinschmidt oral arguments, I believe, on probation and parole holds in the county jails, and the sheriff can boot them out when it's unsafe, that type of thing. But this is truly humbling. And I can see the headlines in the Washburn County Register. Sheriff Dryden hauled before Supreme Court. You know, I can see that happening. If that would keep me elected, I'm not sure. I speak on behalf of the Badger State Sheriff's Association. I've been a sheriff for 17 years. I've been a law enforcement officer for almost 30. I am a street cop. My language to you today is going to be we're going to be short and sweet, and it's going to be vacant of legalese. I am not an attorney. I don't purport to be, and I'm a street cop. That's what we do. However, sheriffs have a unique experience or a unique opportunity and experiences and requirements to our court systems. We are required to serve the court. And that just doesn't mean the court, the bench, the DAs. It means our inmates and our prisoners. We haul prisoners all over this country, continental United States. We haul some very significant violent individuals. Criminals are becoming more and more violent. If this petition can resolve some of those security issues and yet protect the integrity of the court and the litigants, I think this is good. Badger State Sheriffs, to my knowledge, none of the sheriffs that I'm aware of, my other 71 compadres, have an opposition to this. because, well, we're kind of selfish, too, because we're spending a lot of money. And, of course, we have to go to county board to get our money. But, and we haul people over across the state from mental institutions that, I got to tell you, folks, unless you're in a car for 12 hours with a mentally incapacitated person who shouldn't be in a car, who should be in a facility where they can appropriately care for that individual, you know, it's an experience that you probably wouldn't want to do. But I'm here to tell you it's not a pleasant experience. And it's not a pleasant experience either to haul children that are under the age of 10 in the backseat of a squad car from one facility to the next until we determine how we're going to get this young person in front of a judge somewhere. And if we can do that appropriately through video conferencing, that's certainly we serve in the public in that capacity. So with that said, and I ask if you ask me a question, stick it to layman's terms. As I said, I'm a street cop. I can speak. I've been around for a few years, and I can tell you that no sheriff in his right mind, and we all know that sheriffs all have their right minds about them, will oppose this petition, because we believe also in the protection of the litigants, because we don't want to have to go back and get them out of the state prison and bring them back for an appeal. So we want to protect that. We really do. But however, we got some money issues for us, but I know the courts cannot take money and wipe out all the other responsibilities that you have. We understand that. We truly do. With that, I appreciate that. This is truly humbling, Chief Justice, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here. I've known some of you personally. I've had conversations with many of you over the years, more so with Chief Justice than anybody else, I would imagine. But this is truly humbling, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Sheriff, did Badger Sheriff's Association actually take a vote on this?
No, sir, they did not. We meet on regular, on a quarterly basis. We have several members that were the initial. Let me back up a little bit, Justice. We were not a part of the drafting of the petition. We purposely pulled out of that area because we didn't think it was appropriate for law enforcement to be involved in rules promulgated by the court. We didn't know if they'd, truthfully, we didn't think a judge would swallow it. But we backed out of that part of it. But our current president of the Badger Sheriffs is Ron Kramer, sheriff of Eau Claire County. He was on the initial committee as well when all this started up with video conferencing. We were able to get some grants to get the DOC's video conferencing up and running in a lot of the jails and courts. No, sir. I'm not aware of any votes. I do know they know I'm here, and we had a conversation this last couple months at Volk Field when we had our last meeting that anybody that wanted to come along with me, come right ahead. And they're all for it, Justice. But we did not make a formal vote, no, sir.
But nobody said, we oppose it, we don't think this is a good idea, anything like that?
Not to my knowledge, Justice, and I've been in conversation. I email all the other 71 sheriffs, and I have not heard a negative comment about it at all.
Thank you.
Let me just say, Sheriff, that the Badger Sheriff's Association has been active in video conferencing from the very beginning,
yes,
a long time ago, and has been very active in terms of setting up criteria for the video conferencing, both at the jail and then in the courts, and have been very interested as a security measure and as a money measure. My own experience in talking to the sheriffs is if they could, and there weren't constitution, they might try video conferencing for everything, but that they know that
yes.
That's not possible.
No, we know that's not possible. We know that there are times when you got to have the folks there. We understand that.
And that's and in many counties, as you know, the original money for the video conferencing came from the sheriff's budget because the sheriff was able to. The original estimate was that you could replace that money in 2 years, but it turned out, as I remember it, it was replaced in 1 year by the savings you had. Not every county, but in some of the counties.
Yeah, I think John Velker had a term for myself and other sheriffs that he called opening. We're involved because we're the money guys. We can open doors.
Well, right.
We don't open doors. We just flat kick them down. You know,
only with a warrant.
Only with a warrant.
respect your account.
Under your circumstances.
You really reassure us.
This isn't, this isn't recorded, is it, by the way?
It is.
You know, it's been a great experience. The judge and the gentleman here in front of you have put a lot of work into this. And John Velker, I knew John many years ago before he was in this position here. And we've worked on not just this, but court security issues.
That's
and,
right.
We worked with the court security with the training programs and all. And that's another thing I failed to mention is court security. Obviously, that's our responsibility. And tell you what, these guys are getting, there's some wackos out there that we're bringing back, and they're dangerous. And if we can prevent some of that, that'd be great. But and I agree with the counties association. I don't think it was purposely left out, Justice Butler. It was not purposely left out. We've been in conversation. I know Ron Kramer has been in conversation with the Wisconsin counties about this very issue, and we are on the same page. It is an issue for everybody. The key players of the county have to come together to get this done, if the petition passes through, and we certainly support it, and I support it. I think in my humble opinion, this is the right way to go about it by rule. And then if we want to do the legislative thing, as Justice Prosser said, I think that's fine. But I think that process would have taken us a lot longer on the legislative end of it.
Are there any other questions? Thank you. Thank you for appearing, Sheriff. Does anyone else want to appear on this? Judge McMonagle?
I just wanted to comment on the Wisconsin Counties Association point. We certainly have no difficulty confirming, as I said in my opening comments, that the title of this rule is the use of video conferencing in the courts. It's not about acquisition of equipment and wasn't intended to be. And if the court believes that some note should be made in the comments or in some appropriate place to reconfirm that, the committee certainly has no objection because it's consistent with our intent. With respect to the list of people that has been proposed, the committee does have some concerns about that and probably from the opposite intent. This, again, is trying to give judges guidance in how to use the equipment in court proceedings. And while the courts have certainly fostered a good working relationship with their local county boards or county executives, and we agree with the spirit of the Wisconsin Counties Association, we are concerned about the 2,500 county board supervisors who populate the several counties, who may have a view that if that is in there, that somehow vests a law enforcement committee or some obscure group the right to tell the judge how he should use it, and that starts to encroach on what we really intended by this rule. We are not intending to step on any toes. We want to cultivate that relationship, but we really don't want to flip this around so that everything we've accomplished with the rule to give the judges comfort is now going to be abridged because local politics would enter into it, or a judge who is not courageous enough is going to be placed in danger because somebody on the county board thinks that ignoring constitutional considerations or the cautions of the judge, go right ahead and use it. So we think we need to control where the ultimate decision-making is.
When I read the letter of the Counties Association and that particular sentence that you're referring to, a flag went up also, and I was interested in hearing Justice Butler's question regarding that. And you may have heard me ask the presenter if taking out the specifically identified entities would be okay and have something like judges shall work in their respective counties to develop a strategy for increasing the use of video conferencing, taking into consideration, et cetera, the technical and fiscal limitations of the county. That is, taking out the specifically designated entities and making it more generic. Does that solve your problem, or does that still present a problem?
I think it minimizes it when you take out the litany relating to the apparent authorization of county to have a voice in how it's used.
You prefer the
Weimweber
use of
proposed language here.
You prefer the use of acquisition of rather than use. You don't want the group to decide
when it's used in criminal or civil cases, but that what we're interested here is acquisition. The acquisition of the equipment.
Yeah.
I used an analogy when I was speaking by phone with the county's association. If this were a rule about the use of the judge's gavel in the courtroom, we would want the judge to have the primary right to know how he wants to use his gavel, as opposed to someone on the county board saying, we think in addition to bringing a case to order, you should throw it at the dissident person in the first row.
I read the county association's letter is not wanting a mandate that they have to acquire particular equipment, and that is in keeping with us not mandating, which you may or may not agree with, the particular security, et cetera, but that...
We have no objection to that clarification,
right.
Whatever
Got
form.
Got it.
Judge Leinweber has some language that he would like to propose if you...
Okay, what's your language?
Well, what I was going to suggest, Justice Abrahamson, is that rather than altering the language of the rule itself, we simply include in the commentary to 6801 the following. This chapter is not intended to give circuit court judges the authority or compel county boards to acquire, maintain, or replace video conferencing equipment. Rather, it is intended to provide courts with authority and guidance in the use of whatever video conferencing equipment might be available to them.
I understand that. Okay? All right.
There are
Thank
copies
you.
For the court if you wish to have them.
Thank you. Which we could give them to the clerk. Does anyone else wish to appear on 70-12? If not, the hearing on Rules Petition 07-12 in the matter of petition to create a rule governing the use of video conferencing is closed. The court will take several minutes recess, and we'll come back and take a stab at discussing and deciding.